A game that changed everything. A game that changed everything. After Sally passed away, football became Remy's escape, his anchor in a world that had suddenly lost all shape and certainty. He clung to it like a life raft, chasing the ball with the kind of intensity that only comes when you're running from pain. Every morning, long before the first bell rang, he would dash out the door, cutting through the misty air to get to the school's enclosed football cage. That small, concrete pitch became his sanctuary, and when school finished, he'd be back there again, his tie already loosened, his shoes barely holding together, kicking a ball around until the weary school caretaker eventually had to chase the kids off the premises. It didn't matter how tired he was or what the weather was doing. The cage was his therapy, and the game was how he coped. Though he was signed up with Blackheath Wanderers, his spirit wasn't in it. He didn't want a team of strangers in matching kits. He wanted to play with the friends who had seen him cry, who had walked beside him through the quiet storm of grief. Football wasn't about glory. It was about belonging. Then one evening, as we sat at the dinner table, Remy looked up at me with that quiet kind of bravery only children seem to possess in the wake of loss. "Dad, will you manage our school football team?" I blinked. Me? I was no coach, just a loyal West Ham fan. A grieving husband trying to piece life back together. But how could I say no to that face? I laughed awkwardly and said yes. I teamed up with another father, Marco Lenzi, whose sons, Matthew and Stephen, shared Remy's passion for the game. Marco and I were complete novices, two dads fumbling our way through cones and drills, powered by love and good intentions. But what started as a joke about my tactical cluelessness quickly grew into something far more meaningful. The team gave me a reason to stand up again. It pulled me out of my grief, one training session at a time. Marco's wife Helen was a GP, and together they ran Oakview Family Practice, a cornerstone of the local community. While Helen led the surgery, Marco managed the reception desk. They were deeply involved in community work, collaborating with Lewisham Council and the Care Quality Commission, and they quickly became more than teammates. They became family. Cindy McGinnity, the headmistress of St. Margaret's Church of England School, known locally as Lee C. of E. Primary, granted us permission to train the children every Friday after school. But there was a problem. The football season had already begun, and the Lewisham Council League was well underway. There were no open spots. It looked like our little squad would be stuck on the sidelines. Still, I refused to accept it. I rang the council's event manager, hoping for a miracle. And, as if by divine timing, one school had just pulled out of the league due to a shortage of players. If we were willing, we could take their place, but we'd start at the bottom. 0 points, 4 matches behind, no promises. I didn't hesitate. Now that we were officially in the league, it was time to build something real. Not just a group of kids running wild after a ball, but a team. On the first day of training, as I unpacked cones and tried to look like I knew what I was doing, a woman approached me, confident, arms folded, eyebrows raised. "You got a problem with girls playing football?" she asked sharply. I froze. "No, of course not," I stammered. "But, I mean, it's a man's sport, isn't it?" She didn't even blink. "You'll change your mind," she said, and walked off. That woman was Caitlin's mum. And she was right, because that's when I met Caitlin. From the very first morning, she was there. Rain or shine, morning or evening, she trained with unflinching determination, holding her own among the boys and often outplaying them. She wasn't just another player. She was a thinker, a reader of the game. She understood space, timing, vision. When I introduced the concept of one-touch, two-touch football, I knew it might be a challenge. So, I broke it down using something familiar. "Remember Piggy in the middle?" I asked. "When you were younger, throwing the ball over the head of the person stuck in the middle?" Heads nodded all around. I explained how the person in the middle would always face the kid with the ball, completely unaware that another player was sneaking behind, running into space. That moment, the creation of space was everything. "Now," I said, "do it with your feet." Most of them stumbled, but Caitlin got it instantly. She didn't just understand it, she taught it. She helped pull the boys into rhythm, correcting them gently, leading by quiet example. She became the natural choice for captain. Caitlin became the soul of our team. Then there were the boys who became brothers, in every sense but blood. Luke Tatum was one of them. Luke had his own heavy burden to carry. Around the same time Sally passed, Luke's grandfather, Sonny, also died. Luke had been living with his grandparents, Sonny and Audrey, who had stepped in as his primary guardians when his mother couldn't care for him. Losing Sonny left a gaping wound, and Luke struggled to contain it. He came to football angry, coiled like a spring. But he and I, we had an unspoken understanding. Sometimes all it took was a tight hug and a whisper in his ear, and I could see the storm in his eyes start to settle. To this day, Luke remains close as a son. He and Remy were inseparable, on and off the pitch. Brothers, bonded by grief and healed through play. And then there was Ben Spence, a troubled youth with a ferocious left foot and explosive speed. Football was his release, his way out of whatever was weighing him down. On the pitch, the chaos fell away, and what emerged was pure focus, raw talent, and unwavering camaraderie. These boys didn't just play together, they leaned on one another, growing into young men who knew how to fight through pain, who knew what it meant to show up for each other. Remy had a natural flair, a raw, untamed brilliance. He'd pull off a step over or a flick and instinctively look over at me, eyes wide, waiting for praise. But that pause, that need for approval, was enough to lose the ball. But bit by bit, that changed. Through drills and matches, through victories and losses, Remy stopped looking to me for validation. He stayed present, focused, deadly. His skills became part of the play, not a performance. And when he pulled off a bit of magic now, he finished it. A goal, an assist, no hesitation, no need for applause, just the job done right. And then there was Matthew Lindsay, the assistant coach's son. Small in stature, but bursting with talent and sharp intelligence. Like Caitlin, he grasped the secret code of the game, the art of running into space, the cunning of the offside trap. He would linger just long enough, eyes darting, waiting for his moment. Then, with perfect timing, he'd burst forward as Remy lofted the ball over the defender's heads. Matthew would glide onto it, a shimmer of movement, either sliding the final pass to a teammate or coolly slotting the ball into the net himself. The pitch rang with laughter and cheers. The kids weren't just playing football, they were living it, breathing it, having the time of their lives. That season, we defied every expectation. Despite our late start, despite having to claw our way up from behind, we finished the league as runners-up. We were no longer a ragtag group of grief-stricken kids and confused dads. We were contenders. Then came the invitation, a borough-wide cup tournament, a high-stakes six-a-side knockout competition to be played at the Den, home of Millwall FC. On the morning of the tournament, as we gathered the children for the minibus, Cindy pulled me aside. "Good luck," she said kindly, then added firmly, "but if you get knocked out early, you must return the children to school immediately." I nodded, a flicker of unease in my chest, and fate once again dealt its hand swiftly. We were eliminated in the first round. To make matters worse, we found ourselves surrounded by the thunder of cheering crowds, waving banners, classes of children, and proud parents all there in support of the other schools. We had arrived alone. No supporters, no flags, no roars of encouragement, just us, walking quietly back to the minibus, defeated but holding something deeper than trophies. Because we knew. We had already won in a way no scoreboard could reflect. We were rebuilding from loss. We were moving forward. And thanks to Remy, Caitlin, Luke, Matthew, Ben, Marco, and that unforgettable little team, so was I. Our team, in contrast, was a modest affair. No banners, no cheering crowds, just a handful of parents ferrying kids to and from matches in battered hatchbacks. On the day we were knocked out of the tournament in the first round, no one was eager to return to school. The silence on the minibus said it all. Disappointment hung heavy in the air like fog. I reminded them of Cindy's instructions, strict orders to bring the children straight back if we were eliminated early, but there was a restlessness in the group. Heads drooped, but eyes flicked toward me with hope. So I suggested, "What if, instead of school, we head to mine?" There was a pause, and then an eruption of cheers. After Sally passed, I'd quietly transformed our home into a kind of unofficial youth club, a sanctuary for Remy and his friends. The dining room no longer hosted quiet family dinners. In its place stood a 6 feet by 3 feet snooker table, slightly wonky, but loved. The living room was a tangle of beanbags, PlayStation controllers, and the smell of microwave popcorn. It was chaotic, loud, healing. But one rule, I said firmly. No one tells Cindy. The moment we stepped through the front door, the kids exploded like firecrackers. Bags dropped, shoes kicked off, and a thundering of feet up the stairs. Laughter echoed through the house. In a bedroom above me, Remy had discovered Ben's toy handcuffs. Seized by the kind of mischief only boys can conjure, he decided to cuff our poor goalkeeper, Aral Smith, to the radiator. At the time, I wasn't too worried. I figured Ben would be back soon with the key, and besides, the handcuffs were plastic, harmless, surely. But then the clock ticked forward. I had to leave to pick up Josh from school. Other parents started collecting their children, and somehow, in the shuffle, Aral was forgotten. The moment his mother arrived at school and couldn't find him, she went straight to Cindy. There she stood, Cindy McGinnity, headmistress of Lee C of E Primary, rooted like an oak in the playground during pickup, arms folded, eyes scanning. When she spotted me, she raised her hand. "Can I have a word?" My throat closed. I walked over, rehearsing a dozen possible explanations. But before I could say a word, Remy blurted it out. "We got knocked out early. We went to Dad's house, and are all still there, handcuffed to the radiator." The silence that followed could have shattered glass. I wanted the ground to open and swallow me whole. Cindy's eyes didn't widen or narrow. They just fixed on mine with a cold, level disappointment that hit harder than any shouting ever could. I stammered out a half-excuse, trying to explain, but her silence was deafening. Even Marco didn't come to my rescue. Later that night, I cornered him about it. "Mate, you just stood there." He grinned sheepishly and said, "She scares me." And that was that. But out of the chaos, something else was quietly blooming. Diane was more than just another parent on the sidelines. She was Caitlin's and Theo's mum. From the first time we met, there was something about her. Her easy laugh, her fierce loyalty to her kids, the way she moved with quiet confidence, that drew me in. I liked her, more than I expected to like anyone in a long time. As the football season edged toward its end, I learned something else. Diane's birthday was on the 22nd of May. Somehow the thought of asking her out felt suddenly urgent and thrilling. But with it came a wave of nerves and doubt. What if I was overstepping? What if I made things awkward? I confided in Marco. He listened, then grinned that mischievous grin of his and said, "You're asking her out. No backing down now." I did, and she said yes. When the day came, I was so jittery I nearly called it off. But with Marco's new shirt on and a quiet pep talk, I stepped out the door. That evening changed everything. What began as awkward sideline chats, two single parents cheering on our kids, slowly, gently became something more. Life moved forward. Ben Remy, Josh, Caitlin, Theo and the boys continued to train, swim, rollerblade, join Cubs. Marco and I remained close, chauffeurs, sideline coaches, and confidants. We carved out one evening a week for ourselves, Thursday night drinks at the Hare and Billet in Blackheath. It was a few weeks before we discovered, much to our amusement, that Thursday was gay night at the pub. We laughed, clinked our glasses, and quietly moved our tradition to the Princess of Wales at the other end of the heath.